Thank you, Luca. Let me first begin by thanking the organizers, first for inviting me and then being so supportive throughout this visa craziness. And I hope to be there soon. But anyway, I'm very happy to be able to share this different perspective on residual gauge symmetries, which is a bit unconventional when it comes to the study of asymptotic symmetries. So the goal of this talk will be to look at large gauge transformations in electromagnetism and BMS symmetries in BMS supertranslations, to be specific, in gravity, but not in the usual asymptotic context. So we will be looking at residual gauge symmetries in the direct Dirac's front form approach, which he put forward in this beautiful paper in 1949. So in this paper, he had introduced three forms of relativistic dynamics. We are more familiar with the instant form. This one should be the point form. There is a typo. The instant form or the point form, which are these two. But he also introduced a third kind of form of relativistic dynamics, where the time parameter is taken to be a null direction. So just a second. Yeah. So if we take x plus to be x naught plus x three, then this we will have our initial data on a null hypersurface, which is simply this plane, and we can study the dynamics off of this surface in a perpendicular null time direction, which goes like this. And this was basically Dirac's front form, where the idea was to study the dynamics using a null time parameter. Now, the advantage of studying as theory in the front form is that there are three Hamiltonians in the front form. Now, what I mean by three Hamiltonians is the following. Let me first set up the light cone coordinates, which I will be using exclusively in this talk. So we have x plus and x minus, which are just the combination of x naught and x three in four dimensions. Throughout this talk, I will only talk about four-dimensional theories. And then we will have two more spatial coordinates, xi's. Now, if I consider x plus to be my light cone time, the Hamiltonian would be the derivative with respect to x plus, so p lower plus or p upper minus, because the metric is off diagonal. Now, if you look at the Poincaré generators in the usual instant form, let's say we have the four momenta and the rotation generators, which have this kind of Poincaré brackets. And out of these 10 brackets in four dimensions, 10 generators in four dimensions, four of these are actually dynamical generators because they involve time derivatives. So these are what Dirac called Hamiltonians. Now, in the instant form and point form, you have four dynamical generators. But when you write the same Poincaré generators in the front form, it so happens that now you have three dynamical generators, which are the Hamiltonians. And instead of six, you have seven kinematical generators. This way, if you're trying to build an interacting theory from the free theory, and if you want to deform it to an interacting theory, it's much easier to close the Poincaré brackets and find the interacting terms. And this way, it might be easier to construct interacting theories in the front form. Another advantage of working in this Dirac's front form is that oftentimes the constraint equations become solvable, which may not be the case always. It depends on the very subtle choices of gauge or coordinates that you're using. But sometimes one may be able to solve the constraints. And thus, in the usual case, when we have a constrained Hamiltonian system for gauge theories, when we rewrite that system in a Dirac front form, we can get to an unconstrained Hamiltonian system. With this idea in mind, I would like to discuss electromagnetism in the front form and how the residual gauge symmetries give us large gauge transformations in this context. And I would attempt to link these symmetries to the asymptotic symmetries that one finds at spatial infinity. There are some reasons why I would like to do this, which I can discuss later. And then in the second part of the talk, I will focus on gravity and try to recover the BMS supertranslations in the light cone gravity. And we would then like to do a comparative analysis of how these two approaches differ from each other, or which in which aspects are they similar. Now, if you want a one-line summary of this whole talk, it would just be one particular example of light front Hamiltonian analysis and how these are connected to the symmetries at the corner, or let's say at spatial infinity. How are these connected to this asymptotic symmetries one finds at spatial infinity? So there are several ways to look at null front Hamiltonian analysis. I will just look at a one particular example, which is typically known as LC2 formulation, because it will involve two degrees of freedom, basically. And we'll see how these symmetries appear in the LC2 formulation and how one can compare them with the ones that appear at spatial infinity. Now, if you look at electromagnetism in the front form, the typical choice of gauge, which is known as a light cone gauge condition, is to set the minus component to zero. So we can put this combination A0 plus A3 to zero, and then look at the Maxwell equations. What happens is that we get the Maxwell equation for this nu equals plus and minus. They give us two constraints. The first one, it looks like this, and one can actually solve for A upper minus, the third component of the field. One can solve for this if we allow for an integration. So this 1 over del minus can be thought of as an integration operator with some step functions in it. So if you are allowed to do this integration, then we can eliminate A minus in favor of AIs up to two integration constants. So you'll notice that this is a second order differential equation. So it will involve two integration constants. Now, when you look at the nu minus equation, you get another constraint which relates these two arbitrary constants. At the end of the day, we only have one. Now, here we make a further choice to set this constant to zero. And the reason to do this is because it will help us do this del minus integrations freely. If I keep a constant here, then one has to be always careful about the surface terms that might arise when I do a partial integration. Now, the other equation, which is nu equals I, just gives us the dynamical equation for the AI field. These are the two spatial components of the vector field. And we see that it follows this box AI equals zero evolution equation. So these are the two propagating modes of the photon. Now we can go one step further and complexify this XI coordinates. It's again a choice. We may not do this, and we can continue working with AIs and XIs. But the nice thing about this combination is that if you combine XIs as X and X bar, the derivatives also get complexified. You can rewrite AIs in terms of A and A bar. And the nice thing about these fields is that these are the plus and minus helicity states of the photon. And we know this because you can take these fields and act the helicity operator in the light cone Poincaré algebra. You can write a helicity operator, and you will find that these are the eigenstates of this operator with plus and minus one eigenvalues, which is nice. So we can now write the light cone action for electromagnetism in terms of only these two modes. And it's very simple. It looks like this. So this is called the LC2 formulation of electromagnetism, because we have the light cone action in terms of the two modes of the photon. Now, one can also do a Hamiltonian and Poisson bracket analysis with this. So if you recall that X plus is time, we may define conjugate momenta, pi and pi bar. And you will immediately notice that the pi or pi bar, they are not really independent, because they are related to the A bar and A fields with this del minus derivative, which is just a spatial derivative in our case. So this means we can choose to work with just A and A bars. We don't need the pi bar fields. So we find that there are only half the number of degrees of freedom than our conventional 3+1 Hamiltonian formulations. And this is a key feature of all null front Hamiltonian system. It has nothing to do with setting A minus to zero. So the gate choice that I made here has nothing to do with this, because you can just take the Hamiltonian formulation for electromagnetism and rewrite everything in this coordinate system. You will immediately notice that the pi and pi bars, they are not independent variables. And in, if once you have found this, you can find the Poisson bracket for such a Hamiltonian. And it's simply A with A bar gives you a step function like relation. It's not a delta function. And the A's commute with each other. And so that's the A bars. Now, if you ask me what I mean by symmetries in this light cone formulation, it will be, it is defined by a canonical transformation, which takes us from one configuration space. So we have A and A bar, and we make a canonical transformation. We will find some A tilde and A bar tilde, such that the action that we found here is invariant. So this action is invariant under such an action, such a transformation. And the transformation law may also be derived from the Poisson brackets with a generator. So we, if the action is invariant under such a transformation, then we may define a generator, a canonical generator for the symmetry. And the transformation laws also follow from this bracket with the generator. So with this idea, we can try to see if the gauge fixing that we did here, A minus equals zero, does this fix the gauge completely or not? Are there any residual gauge freedom? Is there any residual gauge freedom left in the system? So our goal would be to look at all such gauge transformations where A mu goes to A mu plus lambda mu, such that A minus equals zero is maintained. Now, immediately we get a condition that the lambda, the scalar parameter, cannot depend on x minus. So it can be an arbitrary function of x plus x and x bar, which is nice because that's what we are looking for in a large case transformation. We would like, although it's not immediately clear that this is a U1 angle dependent gauge transformation, but at least it can be an arbitrary function of x and x bar, which is nice. But we have another requirement for this transformation to be a symmetry, which is the invariance of the action. So when we check for invariance of the light cone action, we immediately run into trouble because we have to, we must satisfy this extra condition if we want delta S to be zero. And the problem is this looks like a Laplace equation in complex coordinates. So we know the most general solution would be some holomorphic plus anti-holomorphic parts, which is clearly not the most general function one can write down of x plus x and x bar. So the question is, where did we go wrong? How did we fix a part of the residual gauge symmetry in doing all of these elimination of gauge degrees of freedom? And can we recover the full residual gauge transformation in the system? The problem is exactly this step where we set the constants to zero. Our motivation to do that at this point was to facilitate the 1 over del minus integration or del minus partial integration. But we see that this is a this is too strong. It is too strong to put these integration constants to zero, because this amounts to fixing part of the residual gauge transformation. So if you want to find the full class of large gauge transformations in light cone electromagnetism, we must consider these integration constants in our analysis, because these are the zero modes with respect to x minus. Now, let's say we put back this alpha and beta, and the second constraint gives us another relation between beta and alpha, and so on. So we can put all of this together and into we feed it back into the light cone action. We find some modified light cone action, which now has new terms, which goes like alpha. So we can now look at the residual gauge symmetries again. So alphas will just, the residual gauge symmetry of alpha is just minus lambda. It's like a shift symmetry in the zero mode. And we no longer have the extra gauge condition, which kills the part of the residual gauge transformations like we found here. So we no longer have this condition. to be satisfied. So we can have an arbitrary function of x bar, x and x, x bar and x plus. Now, what does this really mean? How come the zero modes resolve the problem of residual gauge symmetries in this way? And this was actually already found in 95 or maybe even before that, but this picture is from this paper. It actually shows that setting alpha and beta to zero amounts to fixing the residual gauge symmetry partially. And we are not allowed to do this because these are the zero modes of X minus here, and they are a part of the initial data set. So if I set that to zero, my initial data set is incomplete. So this is something which one is not allowed to do because then we reduce the phase space incorrectly. Now, in this paper, they also argued that the Cauchy equivalent of a initial surface in this null, double null sort of formulation would not be just one surface. It won't be just x plus equals zero, which is this A part here. But we also need to complement that with some B, x minus B here, which are some x minus equals constant and here, x minus equals constant, which means that the initial data set for the double null sort of formulation actually has some support on an x plus equals constant surface and some support on the x minus equals constant surface. And we cannot just set these parts to zero. We will not be able to recover the full symmetry in that sense.
Lucetta, sorry. Can you hear us?
Sorry,
there's a question by Simone.
Sorry, just to clarify.
Yeah, please. Sorry, I didn't check the chat.
Hi, sorry, just to clarify. You said they showed that you cannot fix them all to zero because it would reduce the initial data or because it would be inconsistent with the initial data?
I think it would be inconsistent with the initial data.
Right, because you know what I have in mind is that, I don't remember now for electromagnetism, but already for the scalar field in 3 plus 1,
yes.
Part of these zero modes are actually have to satisfy, only the global zero mode is completely free, right? But these local zero modes you're writing, they have to satisfy some consistency relation in terms of the potential you have and everything. So that's why I was thinking maybe it's more an issue of inconsistency rather than arbitrary.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Because these are still very local. These are zero modes just with respect to x minus. There is still an x plus dependence. So maybe the part which is truly a part of initial data set is the x bar dependent part. If you look at a 1 plus 1 system, let's say, then that would be the global zero mode. So I think there will be a problem with the consistency. And there is also some subtlety involved because now these alphas here, the ones that appear in the light cone action, they're also related to the value of this AIs, A and A bar, at the asymptotic infinity. So altogether, we cannot blindly put them to zero, but a part of it, the global zero modes are indeed a part of the data, initial data set. So if we ignore them, then the evolution will not be correct in that sense.
You have also another question, Sucheta, by Laurent.
Yeah, just a clarification.
Yes, please.
Question. I would have expected the zero mode action to be kind of a boundary action, but here you're integrating over dx4. So should I worry that the last term is kind of formally divergent, or can you just write it as a boundary action?
Yeah, actually, yes, you can rewrite this as a boundary action because you see there are these triangles which are del del bars. So you can do a partial integration. This I just wanted to put it in a more simpler form. But indeed, the contribution is a surface integral. And you have to change not just the action. You have to also include the contribution of alpha to all the Poincaré generators, let's say Hamiltonian, the rotation generators, and so on, such that everything together will give you the correct symmetry algebra.
Okay, but don't you get an infinite constant, like integral of dx minus? So you can reabsorb that into alpha somehow,
I guess. Sorry?
Well, I'm just worried about the infinity. The last term is infinite as written. So I'm just, if you don't write it as a boundary action.
But maybe... this has to be a boundary contribution.
Okay.
This, yeah.
All right.
This is probably not it's not correct to write it just like that. There is a boundary contribution which cancels. So this is just the bulk part of the action. So I should have written some plus boundary terms.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Since I am already interrupting you, just to mention you have 5 minutes more, Sushetha.
5 minutes more. Yes. How much? Five.
In total, it's like half an hour, but we are trying to do 25 plus questions. But of course, if there are other questions, you can continue. You have still in total nine minutes. In total.
How much? Nine.
Nine, yes.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
So this is just an example of how residual gauge symmetries can give us sort of asymptotic symmetries in a double null formulation. But the question is, how are these actually related to the corner? Or so to speak, how are these actually related to asymptotic symmetries, for example, at spatial infinity? So I consider spatial infinity here because the analysis at spatial infinity is also Hamiltonian analysis. So it's based on the conventional 3+1 Hamiltonian action. So it might be easier to compare the two if I consider the asymptotic symmetries at spatial infinity instead of null infinity. Now, I will very quickly go over the analysis by Henault-Trossard, where they find the U1 gauge symmetry of the electromagnetic field using starting from the Hamiltonian action. So you have the gauge constraint like so. And then one can take some fall-off conditions such that the action is finite, and all the charges are well-defined, the Poincaré charges, the gauge charges, and so on. And these are the boundary conditions that will give us finite charges. But they also considered something called the gauge twisted parity. So in the old literature, one would consider this kind of a parity condition without the blue term here. Sorry. But if you don't put the blue term here, then you don't have the large gauge transformations anymore. So their novel idea really was to consider this gauge twisted parity condition, because you allow for this A B component, the angular component of the gauge field, to be even up to gauge transformation. So you allow for an odd piece, but it's in a precise form, which is the gauge transformation of the field. Now you can write a canonical generator for the symmetries, which is just a gauge constraint. And they also define this terminology called proper and improper gauge transformation, where if the surface charge is zero, then you get some proper gauge transformation. If the surface charge is non-zero, then it's an improper gauge transformation. So if you set this blue piece to zero, then the charge vanishes. So you only have proper gauge transformations, which you're always allowed to fix. Now, the problem with their analysis was that since they demand a strict invariance of the symplectic form, so you have a symplectic form which looks like this, and if you have the invariance of the symplectic form, you can define a canonical generator associated with a symmetry transformation. And the problem was that when you consider this gauge twisted parity condition, the boost transformations are not canonical generators anymore. So to resolve that, what they had to do is to introduce a surface degree of freedom, which is something called the psi field, but we can forget about the details here. This psi field is actually related to the boundary value of A naught, which is the temporal component of the vector field. And as we know that the temporal component in the 3+1 Hamiltonian analysis is typically considered to be a gauge degree of freedom. But we see that the boundary value of this field is also important if we want to recover the full U1 gauge symmetry. And if, once you consider this extra surface degree of freedom, you can define the complete gauge charge. And you'll notice that half of these symmetries, the even part, comes from the gauge field, and the odd part, mu odd, comes from this new contribution from the surface degree of freedom, and together they form the full U1 symmetry. Now, why did I talk about spatial infinity and asymptotic symmetry of electromagnetism in this formulation? Because I wanted to compare the two approaches the 2 plus 2 approach for light cone electromagnetism and the 3 plus 1 approach for asymptotic symmetries at spatial infinity. And we find that there are some similarities, at least at the formal level, there are some similarities in how these analyses go. So the symmetry in both cases are defined from the invariance of the action or symplectic form. And at spatial infinity, we are really dealing with a boundary value problem, which is formulated on a Cauchy hypersurface. But for the 2 plus 2 light cone formulation, we are looking at a characteristic initial value problem on a null hypersurface. So although these are two different setups, but formally they are a similar type of analysis. And for the spin one case in particular, we find that here in the spatial infinity case, we must include a surface degree of freedom if we want to recover the full U1. And setting psi, this new field to zero amounts to improper gauge fixing. So one is not allowed to do that. And if we look at the 2 plus 2 formulation, we see that we also must reintroduce the zero mode alpha if we want to obtain all the residual gauge symmetries. And setting alpha to zero is not allowed because it fixes a part of the residual gauge fixing. Now, it would be interesting to see how much of these similarities hold if you look at spin 2, for example. Now, if I go to a spin 2 for 2 plus 2 formulation of gravity, there is actually a wealth of literature available in these old papers from 70s and 80s, where they look at a pair of null directions, and then one has a space-like foliation of codimension 2. And the point is that you can, in most cases, you can solve the constraints again, like we did in electromagnetism, and we can go from a constrained Hamiltonian system to an unconstrained Hamiltonian system. And in those cases, it's easier to identify the gravitational degrees of freedom because one can identify them with the conformal metric in this intersection. So for example, this line here, the sigma. Now, we will again focus on the precise example of LC2 gravity, so light cone 2 formulation, which was first introduced by Shirk and Schwartz, where again, the algorithm is the same. We have to set the minus components to zero. So we set these G minus minus and G minus I to zero. So we immediately come from 10 degrees of freedom down to 7 degrees of freedom. And we further parameterize some of the fields in terms of this phi, psi, and gamma ij. So you'll notice this gamma ij has the form of a conformal 2 metric. Now, if you rewrite the light cone metric, it takes this particular form. So everything is given in terms of these 7 functions. Now, since we have 2 null directions, we consider the split, 2 plus 2 split of Einstein equations. So we have some dynamical equations, some constraints, some subsidiary equations, and trivial equations. Now, let us focus on the constraints first. So if you look at the constraint equation R minus minus equals 0, it has this particular form. And remember here, I have only made 3 gate choices, but one is allowed to make 4 gate choices in 4 dimension. So we further set phi to be equal to psi by 2. So we come down from 7 to 6 degrees of freedom. And in doing so, we are allowed to integrate out this psi field in terms of gamma ij. Now again, here integration will involve some constants of integration, so which are set to 0. It says integration, sorry. We set these integration constants to 0 for now. We may again run into some trouble, but we can come back and fix it later. Now, we can look at the other 2 constraints, which will which will help us eliminate some other gauge degrees of freedom, which are G plus I and G plus plus. So this way we come down from 5 to 2 degrees of freedom. And these are exactly the 2 degrees of freedom contained in gamma ij, which is the conformal two metric in our light cone components. And remember, gamma ij actually has determinant 1. So instead of 3, it has only 2 independent degrees of freedom.
Sushetha, sorry now, to interrupt. Can you hear me? You just have one minute left.
Okay, okay, perfect. So now we can write a closed form expression for this action, light cone gravity action, but you can see this is horrendous to work with, and It's very difficult to do Hamiltonian analysis for this. So what we do is we make a perturbative expansion here, and so we expand gamma ij around a flat space with this e to the h sort of perturbation, and we can again combine them into h and h bar fields, such that the Lightcone Lagrangian now has this nice form. And the upshot of this is that h and h bar again represent the plus and minus two helicity states of the graviton. Now I can maybe I will skip this part again, because it's the same story as electromagnetism. We have similar Poisson brackets here, and the definition of symmetry is the same. So if we want to look for residual gauge freedom in this light cone gravity context, we find that the gauge conditions will give us some constraints on how the different components of the gauge parameter look like. And at the end of the day, we get this set of symmetries. But the requirement of light cone gauge, light cone gravity action, invariance of the light cone gravity action, actually puts a further constraint on this y parameters. So we are only restricted to Lorentz rotations. So this condition kills the super rotations for us. So we only have one arbitrary constant, which is the t. Now you can write, look at the transformation laws in terms of h and h bar, and look at the symmetry algebra, which turns out to be the BMS algebra, which is obtained from the residual gauge invariance of light cone action without reintroducing any zero modes. Remember, we set the integration constants to zero, but to find the super translations, to find the BMS algebra, we did not have to reintroduce them in the analysis. But as I said, we have an extra condition here, which kills the super rotations. Maybe if we want to recover the super rotations, we have to go back and carefully turn on the integration constants and see which is related to the super rotation symmetries, and we can then recover the largest symmetries in this context. Maybe I'll skip this part. Yeah. So finally, I can come back to the same question again, that how are these two approaches similar to each other? We see that for spin two as well, for light cone gravity, we did not have to introduce the zero modes in order to obtain super translation. And in the spatial infinity context as well, it was found that one does not need any extra degrees of freedom, extra surface degrees of freedom, to obtain super translations. And again, there is a problem with super rotations, which we don't know how to fix it, but maybe it does indeed include some surface degrees of freedom, which have to be carefully incorporated. Now, with this, I have some concluding remarks, because you may ask, what is the goal of looking at these symmetries in the LC2 formulation, because we can only do a perturbative expansion in gravity, and it's probably not very easy to work with the closed form expression. But there are maybe a few aspects of this formulation which is nice. For example, it's very closely related to amplitudes, because we write the action in terms of helicity states, and these are the states which will appear in a massless scattering process. So there are indeed some works where one can go from the light cone action to MHV Lagrangians, or look at KLT like relations at the level of Lagrangians and so on. Then there is the story of self-dual, anti-self-dual actions. So one can truncate the light cone action to come a single-like action, or some double copy constructions for self-dual sectors. So there is an interesting work on BMS super translations and how one can double copy the large gauge transformations to find super translations, but it only works for self-dual sectors. So we are trying to see if one can construct a double copy formulation for all the BMS symmetries. And another approach would be to look at Newman-Penrose formulation, which is something we are working on. And then a more formal aspect would be to properly look at this Hamiltonian formulation, where we have a first order action with physical degrees of freedom. But as we saw, the role of the gauge constraints and zero modes are very subtle. And it would be nice to properly understand which zero mode, the local ones, how they are different from the local and global zero modes, and how the gauge constraints are either first class or not, and if they generate any symmetries or not, and so on. And lastly, there may be some hope in trying to build a dictionary between these residual gauge symmetries and the asymptotic symmetries. And I will leave you with this very nice picture that I like from an old paper by Goldberg, where it just shows how the Cauchy surface and this null initial surfaces, they sort of talk to each other. So thank you for your attention, and I'm thank sorry you. For going over time.
No problem. Thank you very much. Yes, I suggest that since it seems like I just received an email, it seems like it is true that you're coming here in person and we are over time. I suggest that we thank you again and we will have questions in person once you arrive in 2 days, okay? Because I'm a bit over time. Thank you again very much.
Thank you very much.